Last time I started with this slide, or no, I didn't start with the slide. I introduced this slide as a review to talk about the different electroanalytical techniques that we've been covering. We began the semester with potentiometry, and we talked about the idea that it is based on a galvanic cell, and I wanted you to understand that. Two electrodes, indicator reference, put it together, electrochemical cell that spontaneously produces a potential. Via the Nernst equation, we determine concentration. Then we got into the electrolytic type experiments where we apply a voltage to the cell and cause an oxidation reduction reaction to occur. We discussed controlled potential electrolysis, which was a very simple technique that had many uses, many permutations of controlled potential electrolysis, from electrogravimetry to electrosynthesis and purification and separation and things like that in between. We then began talking about a little more complicated experiment of doing the controlled potential electrolysis versus time, or in other words, looking at the current versus time, measuring the current actually versus time, and that was chronoamperometry. We said also we could do coulometry in a controlled potential mode, so it's really controlled potential electrolysis, but we're measuring the charge or integrating the current versus time. All the same experiment, different things being measured. We mentioned chronopotentiometry, the one of the constant current techniques, and where we apply a constant current and see how the potential changes in the electrochemical cell. We also said that coulometry could be performed in a constant current mode, and it becomes fairly simple. Certainly the calculations become simple because it's current times time. So I have a fixed current, I multiply it times the time, and I have the total charge in coulometry. We got into voltammetry next, and we talked about what I was referring to as linear scan voltammetry or linear sweep voltammetry or something, different names, but all the same thing. And we talked about the fact that it's different. There's a different output wave depending on whether you stir or don't stir the solution. And we got our classic wave or our sort of lopsided peak. And we talked about Nernstein controlled portion of the curve, Cottrell controlled portion of the curve, and we understand all of that extremely well at this point. Then we did DC polarography, and that's where what I was covering at the end of class last time, and we talked about, I'll talk a little bit more about it today. It is a voltammetry experiment, so it is like several of these experiments. E versus time is the applied waveform. It's just a linear ramp, but we're using a dropping mercury electrode, or the DME, and that means that we have some slight differences in the resulting output waveform, partly due to drop growth, which influences which sort of counterbalances the Cottrell decrease in current, because we have an increased area that increases the current. We saw, let's see what happens when we look here. Okay, so it's the same as voltammetry and unstirred, but we're using the dropping mercury electrode. We said that the electrode itself is a pretty ugly beast, actually. The electrode is really this part right here. The polarograph is over here, and the electrochemical cell is down here. We said, we had the little animation of the drop coming out of the capillary and growing and then falling off, growing and then falling off, and a new drop begins to form. We mentioned that there are some advantages to using this. If there weren't, why would anybody go through all the trouble? Well, there are several advantages. We get that new drop, new electrode surface, that prevents a buildup of impurities, gives you a nice clean surface for electrochemistry. And we also have the fact that because mercury forms an amalgam or a mixture, essentially an alloy, with many metals, the metal dissolves into the mercury. We only have then in that concentration polarization problem that we talked about, we only have diffusion one way. There's nothing diffusing away from the electrode surface because it's actually dissolving into the electrode. There is a high hydrogen over potential or over voltage for mercury, and that gives us quite negative potentials if we'd like. And then I mentioned expansion of the drop counteracts the diffusion limited current or the Cottrell equation current that we normally see. So instead of getting a peak, we get a wave. I'll show you in a minute another polarogram. Several disadvantages. The mercury oxidizes. That means that it, on the oxidizing end of the potential scale, there will be a limit to the positive potentials that you can go to, limited by mercury oxidation. And so that's a bit of a drawback. You can't go to positive potentials, you can go to negative potentials. Negative potentials are good for reducing metals, so mercury turns out to be a great electrode for doing metals. It does work for some organic functional groups, but not others. The dropping mercury electrode is pretty cumbersome, as we saw, very fragile, okay, and combine that with toxic mercury, and you got a real recipe for disaster. All right. Mercury can be fairly costly if we are dropping drops, drop all day long. If that's your business, you're in electrochemistry doing polarography, you could end up with quite a bill for the mercury that you're using in your dropping mercury electrode. Got to have high purity mercury. Triple distilled is the norm. And then you have to worry about air oxidation. If you leave your dropping mercury electrode sitting around for a while, a film of mercury oxide, which is black essentially, forms on the top of this nice silvery pool of mercury that you might have in your electrode. And that can clog things up. I showed you these two automated versions of the dropping mercury electrode. EG&G, Princeton Applied Research, uses a static mercury drop electrode. They call it a static mercury drop electrode. And then Bioanalytical Systems has a controlled growth mercury electrode. Same idea. Mercury flow is not done strictly by gravity, but it's controlled by solenoid valves and so forth inside of these devices. And so you get a better, more reproducible, it eliminates some of those problems. The fragile nature of the electrode, the cumbersome nature of the electrode, the concern about mercury toxicity and spilling and all that kind of stuff is all kind of taken care of by these systems. I showed you this slide last time to help you understand that we're doing voltammetry, so we have a Cottrell equation drop-off in the current, but the drop area is increasing just in a geometric fashion according to this equation. So the A plugs into here, and we end up with the Ilkovich equation, which is actually these two equations. Either one is fine. Ilkovich figured out the math to describe the polarographic phenomenon, and he did it for, let's see, if we have our wave, if we have these zigzags due to the drop, we can either talk about the maximum current or the average current. Okay, maximum current on top of these little peaks, average current in the middle. So, max current, you use 708 as your constant in the Ilkovich equation. Average current, you use 607. Doesn't matter. Okay? Should you memorize these equations? Memorize everything. Okay? but you don't need to memorize them for the exam. However, you better know what M is. What's M? It's actually mass flow rate. So, wrong. Okay, it's mass flow rate. It is let's see, what I had on the last slide, wasn't it? Okay, mass flow rate in milligrams per, some amount of weight per time. So it's not just the mass of the drop, okay? It's mass per time. And maybe you get partial credit. I'll give you half credit, okay? Okay. All right, so you need to know what all these parameters are for the exam, all right? And that should be easy, right? Should be easy. Okay, we talked about a couple of polarographic waves here. This is a nice one. You say nice, it's all this ugly, hairy stuff. Well, this is what it looks like. Max current, this is a cadmium. Cadmium is actually very well behaved in electrochemistry in general. Very reversible system, fast electron transport. And so you get this nice half wave potential. You get this nice half wave type system, which you can determine the half wave potential for cadmium, which is right around negative 0.6 volts. Versus the saturated calomel electrode. Right. Now, the half wave potential I mentioned to you will tell you what it is you're dealing with. If you were doing lead, lead would come out here, I think. If you're doing copper, copper would come out over here. If you were doing zinc, zinc would come out over here. There's a lot of metals you can do. They come out in different places. Some of them are real close. And so you can't do certain metals together. What comes to mind? Tin and... there's a common interference I'm trying to remember all of a sudden. I'm blanking on it. I think it might be lead and tin have a very close half-wave potential. And if they're together in your solution, you're not able to resolve them by DC polarography. Remember what we're talking about. DC polarography. We can go to other electrochemical techniques, and we'll talk about variations on polarography probably by the end of class. So, oh, thank you. So, you may have a problem resolving two species with very close E1 halves. Now, since we're talking about E1 half, the potential, this sort of looks a little bit like the Nernst equation. The potential for that that you apply with the dropping mercury electrode gives rise to some current. And so we have currents over here. Remember, ID is the diffusion current. So I get my polarographic wave, and the ID is this maximum or this current that the wave levels off at. At any potential applied, in other words, I got a series of potentials, right? I'm applying E, actually, that's not what I'm doing. I'm applying E and I'm measuring I. Okay, that's my typical polarographic wave. So, anywhere along this curve, this sort of Nernstian-looking equation applies. Every potential that I apply is equal to E1 half minus RT over NF, natural log, of the current. Okay, so I have a relationship for the potential applied and the current that is produced in the polarographic system based on an E1 half, which is like an E0, but not the same as E0. It is an intrinsic potential that is not at standard conditions. It's under whatever conditions I'm using. So I can look up in a book or in a table values of E1 half for the particular system I'm interested in. My particular chemical compound, the pH, the ionic medium, the electrolyte that I'm using. So I say, okay, I want to do cadmium. What was that example? The last example was it was in HCl, I forget. So you can look up an E1 half for cadmium It's a dropping mercury electrode, and we know the medium that we're in. So that E1/2 would be a constant for my system. I would then be able to relate the potentials that I apply along the x-axis with the currents that I measure on the y-axis, or in other words, all the points along this curve. The diffusion current is that limiting current, that maximum value that I reach. And, of course, we know that halfway, why does it do that? Halfway to that diffusion current, to that limiting current, I would have the E1/2. Okay, so halfway to the maximum, I'm going to have my E1/2. All right, says here a plot of the log, base 10 logarithm, of that ratio of currents versus the potential, which is the E that I'm applying to my dropping mercury electrode, should give me a straight line. If it's a reversible, well-behaved system, it'll give me a straight line with a slope, okay, with a slope that is related to this part of the equation. Actually, include in there the logarithm part of it. Oh, actually, no, that's not right. I'm plotting log, so I've already included that. So it would give me a plot that would give me a slope of the RT over NF. That slope, or that plot, is used to determine if the system is reversible. If it's a straight line plot, then I have a reversible system. If the plot is curved, I have some amount of irreversibility in my system. Okay, so it's used to establish reversibility. It also allows us to determine N, because N is part of that slope. So I can just figure out from the slope, if it's 0.059, N is 1. If it's 0.02 whatever, then it's N is 2, and so forth. Okay. We can also determine E1/2, because the E1/2 is going to be an intercept, right? This is if I'm plotting on my plot, base 10 logarithm of this, I guess you can include that, versus E, then I've got the slope, and then E1/2 is the intercept. Okay? So the E1/2, again, is characteristic of the species. I can get an accurate value of that by making that plot. And then, as we said before, the ID, the diffusion limiting current, is that quantitative piece of information. Tells me how much of the stuff is there. Sometimes I don't even care. Sometimes I just want to characterize the system, and it doesn't really matter how much of the stuff is there. I may just want to know what it is. Okay, that what the species is. I may want to know something about its reversibility. I may want to know N for the system. Maybe it's an unknown system. Maybe it's an organic compound that my friend, the synthetic organic chemist, just gave me, and I want to do some electrochemistry of it, and then I would do this kind of experiment and not even concern myself with the diffusion current. Okay, let me mention one other interesting phenomenon, interesting fact. This will be a help you remember something that I told you before. When we do all electrochemistry, no matter what it is, potentiometry, any form of voltammetry, okay, the species that we are actually measuring is the free ion. And it's actually the free ion activity. I told you before, free ion activity. Not necessarily concentration. If we're in a concentrated electrolyte system, concentration and activity are not equal to one another. Okay, the activity is always less. It can either be equal to the concentration in dilute solutions, very dilute solutions, at infinite dilution, or it can be less than the concentration. It can never be greater than. So I'm going to be actually measuring activity with my electrochemical system. Pretty much any electrochemical system is going to measure activity. What happens if I bind the chemical species, like the cadmium that we just did a minute ago in our polarographic example? If the cadmium is bound to some complexing agent, like EDTA, ethylene diamine tetracetic acid, is a great universal chelating agent or binding agent. What if I make a cadmium EDTA complex? I take a solution that has cadmium in it. I throw some EDTA in there. I adjust the pH such that the complex forms. I have some amount of free cadmium ion and some amount of bound cadmium EDTA complex. My electrode responds to the free ion activity. It probably says that on here somewhere. Okay. My electrode only responds to the free ion, and it's going to measure activity. So it's only going to measure the cadmium ion, not the cadmium EDTA complex. Now, you might say, well, that's a problem. If I'm trying to measure the total amount of cadmium in my system, that could be a problem for you. There are chemical solutions. Chemists have solutions. And so there are solutions to that problem, but it also could be an advantage because I may want to know something about the binding cadmium and EDTA. I may want to know something about the boiling time. I may want to know something about the stoichiometric reaction between cadmium and EDTA. Now, we all know it's one-to-one reaction, but it doesn't have to be. We could be measuring cadmium binding to a dithiocarbamate. That's a bidentate ligand that will form at least two complexes, or two ligands will bind to the cadmium ion. Might even be three in some cases. So the stoichiometry of the reaction between the metal and the ligand might be something that I might be interested in, and so I can get at that with electrochemistry. If I was going to do this experiment with, if I wanted to measure cadmium and I had an atomic absorption instrument, I would only get the total cadmium concentration. If I had an ICP mass spec, I would only get the total cadmium concentration. Those techniques, those spectroscopic techniques, will not tell me anything about the different species of cadmium that are present. They're going to burn the sample, destroy it, and tell me the total amount of cadmium. Electrochemistry has the ability to measure different species. So, in polarography, okay, that we're talking about, the complexation reaction, okay, affects the E1/2 for the metal ion. I often invoke physical chemistry, and I'll do it again. I hope that doesn't bother you. But remember that the physical chemistry, all analytical chemistry is applied physical chemistry. We want to take some physical chemistry principles and use them to measure substances, and therefore we do analytical chemistry. But the physical chemistry is at the root of it, at the heart of it. So I'm going to relate this a little bit to physical chemistry. The E1/2, now what is E? E is potential. Potential, okay, is electromotive force. And EMF, okay, is, and I told you, and we could write the equation, delta G, free energy, is related to E. So the amount of potential that I apply to my system and where I see things occur, at what potentials I see them occur, intrinsically has to do with the amount of energy that I'm putting in the system. If I don't put enough energy into the system, I don't get a conversion. So if I'm reducing cadmium at a mercury electrode, dropping mercury electrode, little drops of mercury coming out, and cadmium ions are being reduced from cadmium 2 plus to cadmium metal, that intrinsically has some energy that is required to cause that process to occur. Therefore, free energy, a certain free energy, will cause that reaction to occur. A certain electromotive force, or E value, is intrinsic for that process. It says here, who changed the slide? Well, I wasn't looking. I got to figure out what's going on with this. Okay. It says here that the E1/2 is affected by the complexation. Why is that? Because the complexation reaction also is a free energy related process. As a matter of fact, we could also write the equations, the thermodynamic equations, that relate equilibrium constants, K values, stability constant of the complex, to free energy. So if I'm binding EDTA, in the example that I gave you, if I'm binding cadmium with EDTA, there's a process occurring there that has some free energy associated with it. And if I'm trying to do electrochemistry, the E that I measure is going to be changed by this other process that's going on, this binding reaction. So it says the effect of complexation on the E one half of the metal ion, that's the title of my slide here. Typically we measure just the free metal ion, and that has a specific E one half value. When I bind the metal, okay, this would be cadmium in our example, this is what we're measuring. Some ligand, in my example, it's EDTA, some number of them, some X, 1, 2, 3, binds the metal, forms a complex. It's not measured in my system. However, and then, of course, I can write an equilibrium expression for that, a mass action stability constant or formation constant can be derived for that system. If I then do my experiment, okay, so this reaction is going on, and I begin to measure this, what's happening? I got a dropping mercury electrode. I'm reducing the metal. Metal ion is getting to the surface of the electrode, reducing and dissolving into that, amalgamating with the mercury. I'm removing cadmium from the system. I'm removing it. What happens? This stuff dissociates, notice my big arrow, dissociates to give me more metal and more ligand because I've removed some of this metal from the system by my electrochemical process. The electrochemistry, the instrument, responds to that or says, hey, I've got cadmium in the system, some amount of free cadmium, but in order to get that cadmium to reduce, okay, I've got to get it to be released from the complex. That takes more energy. There's some energy associated with that complex. So in order for me to get that cadmium to become free and then be reduced at my mercury electrode, I need to apply more energy. What happens is the E one half value shifts. It shifts by an amount associated with the free energy for the binding of the cadmium by the particular ligand of interest. So, if that's the case, if this is my theory, if this is what I understand to be the case, or my hypothesis, I guess I would say, then, I've written it here, it says, the voltammetric method can actually remove the metal ion from the solution. It does it in a passive way. Okay, it does it, let's see. I'm reducing the metal. It's dissolving into the mercury. I create a polarization, a concentration polarization effect. The complex releases metal to alleviate that lack of or that depletion of metal. And I see a shift in my E one half. Okay, so two effects take place. Takes more energy to reduce that metal that's bound up in the complex, and the E one half shifts in order to demonstrate or showing me how much energy it took to do that. Does that make sense? Okay, that makes sense to you. What's going on here? Something different. I got a different system. It's not just plain cadmium. It's cadmium plus EDTA. And I see that influence the E one half for my system. My I versus E curve shifts. In one case, it goes to more negative potentials. Why? Because it takes more energy to reduce that cadmium. So I'm going from here over to here. And that delta E in the delta E one half is related to the free energy associated with the binding of that metal to the complex. Okay, so there's my delta E. Extra energy required to reduce the metal from a complex results in E one half that is more negative than the E one half for the metal alone. So here's the E one half for the metal alone. Here's the E one half for the complex. There's a delta E. If I plot delta E versus concentration of the ligand that I put in. So in other words, I have a cadmium solution. In the one I had before, it was like 5 times 10 to the minus 5th molar. That's not bad. It's the upper micromolar range. It's like, what's that, 50 micromolar? And I basically titrate the system with EDTA. I'm doing an EDTA titration, and I'm measuring cadmium. I'm not measuring it by an electrode, like an ion-selective electrode. I'm measuring it by a polarographic method. I keep titrating. In the beginning, I probably only have a little bit of EDTA, and I'm only binding some of the cadmium. What I see mostly is a big wave due to the free cadmium, and it appears in the normal location. As I add more and more ligand, I bind up more and more of the cadmium, okay, and it takes more energy to release that and allow it to reduce and amalgamate with the mercury. So my E1/2 begins to shift. I plot the delta E versus the natural log of the concentration of this ligand, EDTA. I can get from that, and I didn't bother deriving the equation for you. It's really not that complicated. But, you know, based on the things that we saw over here, okay, we have an equilibrium constant. It has some stoichiometry, number of ligands. All right, and it says here I can determine K, that K sub F, and X, the stoichiometry from the complex, by this plot of delta E versus log, natural log of the ligand concentration. All right, equilibrium shift caused by at least the metal ions. Okay, now. That's number one. I can get a shift in the E1/2. I can measure some intrinsic parameters about my system, equilibrium constant, X, the stoichiometry. But back to my original, one of my original statements was, this could be a problem for you. What if the boss came to you and said, I want to know the total cadmium, and all you got is a polarograph to measure it with? You say, wait a second, this could be trouble. If I have a ligand in there that's binding the cadmium, I may not measure all the cadmium. What do I do? I told you chemists have solutions. Okay, what you do is you break up the complex. There are several ways in which you could break up the complex. EDTA is a weak acid. Okay, it's ethylene diamine tetraacetic acid. It's got 4 acetic acid groups on it. If I acidify the system to a very, very low pH, okay, a lot of acid in there, I'll break up the complex. The cadmium EDTA complex will not form at very, very low pH. So I could break up the complex. Now all the cadmium is free, and I could measure the total cadmium with my polarographic system. If I bring the pH back up to 5 or 7 or something like that, I bind the EDTA and the cadmium, and I only measure the free cadmium and not the bound cadmium. So there are ways of doing this. There's other ways of doing it too. If I went down to the Lowell wastewater treatment plant, okay, I went into the wastewater treatment plant and I got a sample, because it stinks in there, okay, and I took a sample of wastewater and I brought it to the laboratory and it's dirty, smelly stuff. That's bad for electrochemistry for a couple of reasons. One, all that organic material in that sample, some of it's binding some of the metals. But I want to measure the cadmium. I could try the acidification technique, but you know there's another problem. Some of that organic material is surface active and coats my electrode and fouls my electrode and makes it behave poorly. I could irradiate the solution with ultraviolet light and destroy the organic material. That's another way I could break up the complex. I could do a digestion on a hot plate with acid and cook up the sample and destroy the organic material. So there's several ways in which I could get rid of the potential complexing materials and release the cadmium, release the metal ion, so that I could measure it by my polarographic or whatever electrochemical technique. All right. Meanwhile, my slides have been doing their own thing. Okay. All right. Equilibrium shift caused by release of metal ion from complex can cause errors in analysis depending on the complex kinetics. Okay, let me mention one other phenomenon. That process that I talked about when I am reducing the metal ion at the mercury electrode, and I see a release of it from the complex. The kinetics of the complex have some role in this whole process. If the electrode kinetics are fast, and they are for cadmium, cadmium is very reversible, good electrode kinetics, but for something like copper, they're not so fast. Okay, there's a little somewhat semi-irreversible type process. The kinetics of the complexation reaction may cause an error in my analysis if they're slow. If the kinetics of the release of the metal ion are slow compared to my electrode reaction. So I do have to be concerned a little bit about the kinetics of everything. I always have to worry about rates of reaction. All right? I have to worry about whether it's what the processes are. Most analytical measurements have some time scale. I mentioned NMR the other day. NMR has a time scale. It has a time scale over which you're measuring the process, the phenomenon that you're measuring. The same is true with electrochemistry. Different electrochemical techniques based on the scan rate, that's the primary parameter in electrochemistry that's going to determine the time scale of the measurement, is the scan rate of that you're applying the voltage, or that you're changing the voltage. And so that is going to influence or be influenced by the kinetics of the system. Okay, let me mention a couple of operational aspects of polarography. When you're doing polarography, this is what this means. Okay, what do you have to consider while you're doing this experiment? You have to consider oxygen. Oxygen is usually purged out. We saw before I had nitrogen or argon or something purging, or helium, getting rid of the oxygen. Oxygen can reduce in and of itself and cause an oxygen wave in your experiment. Oxygen can can undergo this reduction to peroxide. There are some other reactions that oxygen can undergo. There are at least two oxygen waves, actually, but this is the one that's primarily a problem. Again, remember, this is a recurring theme. Sometimes a problem comes up, but you can make it into a solution. If you've ever measured or been involved in blood gas analysis, you know, you go to the hospital, and they want to know what your oxygen levels are in your blood, right? And nowadays they put that little thing on your finger. You know, they put a little thing on your finger. You know what I'm talking about? Anyway, well, that's a way to measure blood gas, or it measures oxygen. They sometimes take a sample of your blood and send it to the laboratory and put it into a blood gas analyzer. And it measures not only oxygen, but it might also measure CO2, might measure some other gases also. When they do that, a typical blood gas analyzer does the measurement in a voltammetric, using a voltammetric technique. Let's go back two slides. Oh, no. Let's go forward two slides. No, back two slides. I want to go back. That's where I want to go. Right here, yes. This reaction, electrochemical reaction of oxygen, the reduction of oxygen, is the process by which oxygen is typically measured in a blood gas analyzer, in a laboratory instrument where they put some blood in it to determine what the blood gases are. Oxygen is measured voltammetrically by the reduction of oxygen. If you were to measure oxygen levels in natural waters, somebody says, the fish are dying in the Merrimack River. Maybe it's because there's low oxygen levels. And sure enough, somebody goes out, and sometimes you see the U.S. Geological Survey guys standing on the bridges, and they're lowering down probes into the river. And a lot of times they're just measuring the height of the river. But they're also measuring dissolved oxygen levels. You get below 4 parts per million, and the fish are dying. You want to be up around 10 parts per million, and that's healthy. Okay, that's healthy for the fish. The device, the probe that measures the oxygen levels, is a voltammetric electrode. It's a gold electrode with a membrane over it. Why a membrane? Keep out all the other gunk, right? All you care about is oxygen. So gases diffuse through the membrane, and then they get reduced at a gold electrode, and you can measure oxygen levels. So oxygen, my point here was that oxygen can be a problem in polarography, so you get rid of it. But the reason it's a problem is because it can be reduced and causes a signal, and that process, the fact that oxygen causes a signal, can be used in many applications to determine oxygen levels. Okay, there's another problem called the polarographic maxima, maxima is plural. Polarographic maxima or polarographic maximum. This is an interfering peak, and it shows up sometimes in a polarogram. This is the peak right here. That's the polarographic maximum. The theory is that those little drops, when they get big enough and they fall off, cause a little bit of convective mass transport. Now, the system is supposed to be diffusion controlled. We're supposed to be doing voltammetry unstirred with a dropping mercury electrode. But the dropping mercury electrode causes a little bit of convection current to flow in the system, and it manifests itself as a little peak on top of the wave. Okay, the wave should be flat across here. There is a trick that polarographers have... Stop doing that. Have developed over the years, and that is they add something called Triton X100. What is Triton X100? Well, urban legend has it that it was a surfactant developed to wash the bugs off of airplane windows. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but it's a good surfactant. Okay, Triton X100 is a really good surfactant. And levels of the surfactant that are used are in the neighborhood of 0.001% in solution. So just a tiny amount of Triton X100 creates enough of a surface active solution that prevents this at the surface of the drop of the mercury drop. That is presumably caused by convection currents. Okay, so that's the answer, and you can try it yourself. And if you have an airplane, you can try to wash the bugs off the window. Okay. Okay. Here's my summary slide for DC polarography. Polarography is good for many metals. Remember Hayrovsky, 100 years ago. 100 years ago, Hayrovsky was in his prime, and he was measuring. Metals, and he was measuring simultaneously 3-4 metals at a time, and everybody was saying, the man's a genius. Let's give him the Nobel Prize. So they did. Polarography works very well even at high salt concentrations. A lot of spectroscopic techniques like atomic absorption don't work very well at high salt. Okay, at high salt concentration causes problems. Graphite furnace AA, you get this huge amount of salt being vaporized from your sample. It gums up your graphite tube. It coats your electrode. It causes light scattering in the during the vaporization. So if you got to get rid of all the salt first before you look at the metal of interest. It's a problem. Electrochemistry, not a problem. Salt is good. Okay, the saltier it is, the better it is. All right. And so this is a sort of complementary nature of these techniques. Okay, we can do besides the metals, we can also do many organic functional groups. That's not my particular expertise, so I haven't talked a lot about it. But you can reduce nitro groups to amine groups, for example. Many organic functional groups that you can analyze by polarography. And some of the handouts that I gave you have lists of them and show you what potentials you would expect those functional groups to reduce or oxidize at. We can use it to study the complexation process, not just the total metal ion concentration, but also the equilibrium constant for the binding reaction of a metal with a ligand. That's a good thing. DC polarography has been replaced by other polarographic variations. I'll talk about those maybe by the end of class. I'll start to talk about them. There are better ways of doing the experiment, but this is the basic experiment. Dropping mercury electrode, linear ramp applied potential, measure the current. Okay. Remember that my original statement at the beginning of the semester when we talked began to speak about electrolytic voltammetry was that electrochemists are trying to come up with means of handling the capacitive current better. Capacitive current, remember that on the in polarography, okay, I versus E, we get a sloping baseline. Okay, this sloping baseline is due to capacitive current. If I have too much capacitive current and too little Faradaic current, this is the Faradaic current, or IF. Okay, this is IC. If I have too little IF and too much IC, I can't tell the difference. I can't tell how much of the stuff I have. I lose my quantitative analysis capabilities because I cannot distinguish between Faradaic and capacitive current. Or they become similar, and I have this big interference or this big error in my analysis. DC polarography doesn't do anything great for that differentiation between I Faradaic and I capacitive. Other variations on polarography will improve on that. Therefore, the working range for polarography, DC polarography, 10 to the minus third, 10 to the minus fifth. So when we were doing 5 times 10 to the minus fifth molar cadmium, we were at the bottom end of the range. Okay, we were at the bottom end of the micromolar range where DC polarography can be applied. But that's still pretty good. Still better than most techniques. And again, going back to the days of Hieroski, this was a great advance. The precision is pretty good, 1 to 2% if you're a really skilled electrochemist. We got a couple other things. We can do several metals together. We can measure, we have a little difficulty in measuring one species in the presence of a large excess of a second species. And remember, I said I versus E. If I have a big wave and then a little wave on top of it, I'm going to have a hard time measuring that little wave because the big wave takes all my available sensitivity or the whole scale, and I'm only able to I'm not able to measure the second species with any great sensitivity. That's a problem. If I have a complex matrix like the wastewater, sludge, biological samples, they can foul the electrode. I might have to do another procedure. I mentioned acid digestion or UV irradiation or something to clean up the sample so that I don't have all that gunk in there, those surface active things, those dirty, smelly stuff that I got down at the wastewater treatment plant that's going to mess up my electrode. So it's an extra step. May not be necessary in other techniques, you know, spectroscopic techniques or whatever. It's definitely necessary in electrochemistry to make sure that the matrix, the sample, is not too dirty. And, okay, there are many variations, which I said we're going to talk about. Okay, now I'm going to take a little interlude. That's a fancy word for we're going to stop talking about electrochemistry per se, and I'm going to tell you about calibration methods. Calibration methods in electrochemistry is what my topic is because we're talking about electrochemistry. But these calibration methods can be applied not only to electrochemistry, but to all sorts of other techniques as well. I'm going to give you 4 common calibration methods that are used in analytical chemistry that can be used in electrochemistry, but can also be used with other analytical methods as well. The first one is absolute calibration. Electrochemists don't do this, or chemists don't do this a lot, but you can. You can do absolute calibration. My definition of absolute calibration is that you use a theoretical relationship to determine the concentration. I don't use a standard. I use a theoretical, the fundamental relationship that governs the process at hand. I use that to figure out how much stuff I have. I'm interested in this right here, concentration. I happen to be doing, in our most recent few moments, we've been doing polarography, DC polarography. The Ilkovich equation this equation right here governs DC polarography and polarography in general. So I take my sample of my unknown, no standards, just have an unknown, put it in my electrochemical cell, I measure the current, I measure the diffusion limiting current, okay, that the top of the wave. That's I. I go to a book. Someone says to me, remember, we're doing cadmium today, so let's continue with cadmium. Boss gives me cadmium sample, says, measure this without a standard. Okay. I happen to know that cadmium has an N of 2. There's 2 electrons necessary to reduce Cd2+ to cadmium metal. I go to a book, and I look up the diffusion coefficient for cadmium. We were doing it hydrochloric acid at some concentration. So I go to a book or a table and I look up the diffusion coefficient for cadmium ion in 1 molar HCl or whatever it was that I was using. You'd have to go back and look. So I've got N, I've got D, I've got 708. I then must measure these two things. How do I measure the mass flow rate? I put a little container under there and I measure the amount of mercury that comes out of the electrode, you know, drop grows, falls off, drop grows, falls off. And I wait about, 5 minutes. That's probably too long. I fill up. Anyway, I wait for a while, and then I weigh the amount of mercury, and I determine the mass flow rate. I determine M. Now, I could probably do that pretty accurately because I can make a weight measurement quite accurately, and if I measure over a longer period of time, a large quantity, I can do that quite accurately. So I can measure the mass flow rate, and of course I can measure time. So I know all the parameters. I know everything in the system. So therefore, I can measure. I can plug in all these numbers. Plug in all these numbers, and measure C based on the I that I measured in my polarographic system. Simple. Okay? Simple, not the most reliable method. Okay? Not the most reliable method. Because, first of all, you have to measure M and T very accurately. So I better be sure that when I'm collecting those drops of mercury, I'm not collecting a little bit of water. What if the mercury was in my electrochemical cell that had an HCl solution in it? What if the mercury has water associated with it, HCl solution associated with it? Well, that would be an error. Okay. What if I make a mistake in measuring the M or the time or whatever? Got a problem there. What if I can't find the D, the diffusion coefficient, for the 1 molar HCl that I'm working? Maybe the book says 0.1 molar, but doesn't have 1 molar. So I say, well, that's close enough. Error, right? That's an error. What if there's something else in my solution that's causing me not to get the results, the same signal, the same response that I see for just cadmium in pure 1 molar HCl? All of these are a problem. In addition to all of that, I have not in any way accounted for the capacitive current that might be present in my system . Okay, capacitive current. I measured the current over here, but maybe I drew the baseline down here. We called it diffusion, ID, diffusion current. How do I know where to draw the baseline? I might have to extrapolate this curve somehow. I may have an unknown amount of capacitive current causing an error. So, and remember, this whole thing is going to be related to how high my concentration is. If my concentration is really high, capacitive current's probably a very, very small... Hey, stop that. It's probably a very, very small portion of the total. If the concentration of the cadmium is really low, my capacitive current could be significant. Could be 50% of my total current. And so I've got a huge error. So absolute calibration can be done and is done in some techniques other than electrochemistry, People do it in other, you could do it in spectroscopy, right? If you know the molar absorptivity of a substance, you can measure its absorbance, use the molar absorptivity and the path length, and from Beer's law, you can determine concentration. But usually we use standards, right? So it's absolute calibration is possible and is done sometimes, but not the best way to do things, okay? The next calibration technique is the technique of using a calibration curve. We've all done it. Everybody's measured some calibration curve. Even if you've measured, if you've gone to the laboratory and wanted to measure pH and calibrated your electrode with pH buffers. The pH buffers are standards. They're pH standards. And you take a pH 4, pH 7, pH 10, 3-point calibration curve. I've calibrated my meter. Now I measure unknown solutions, determine their pH. Okay, I've got it. So in electrochemistry, people often do calibration curves. How do they do that? They go to the laboratory, they get their system set up, they take their electrochemical cell, they put a standard solution in it, put it onto their, I'm doing this because a lot of times you've got your electrodes hanging down, so you've got to put the electrochemical cell under there, okay? And you make a measurement of the current produced by that standard. You take that off, you dump it down the drain. Never dump anything down the drain. What are those drains for? Just for looks. Okay. And you rinse it out with distilled water, okay? And you put in another standard, and you put that on there. And of course, you may have to purge with nitrogen, okay, to get out the oxygen. And then you do your polarography experiment, and you get another current for the new standard. And then you take that one off and you dump it out and rinse and put a new standard in. And you build a calibration curve of current versus concentration. Takes some time, though, because I'm sitting there making measurements and dumping out solutions and rinsing things off with I got to rinse off my electrodes, too, because they have residual solution from the previous experiment. Got to make sure I rinse them off and don't have cross-contamination of one standard to the next. But I build a calibration curve. I then measure my unknown, get its current. Okay, let's say this is my unknown. I measure my current level, all right, and then from the graph, from the plot, my calibration curve, I determine concentration. Okay, so everybody knows how to do calibration curve. The third method of calibration that is often used or sometimes used in electrochemistry is the idea of using an internal standard or a pilot ion. Now, the term in electrochemistry is often used as a pilot ion. In mass spectrometry, people use internal standards all the time. Right? You're gonna measure some organic compound by GC mass spec. We were doing PAHs. Okay? We were doing polyaromatic hydrocarbons, naphthalene, anthracene, things like that. Went to the catalog. Deuterated anthracene, and ran those and with a mass spectrometer as a detector, you can clearly see the difference between the deuterated compound and the undeuterated natural material. And so I look at the response for the two, and I say, okay, I'm just going to assume the response is the same for both species. And therefore, I don't need to have a standard for naphthalene. I just use a deuterated, or substituted naphthalene compound as my standard. The same idea is true in electrochemistry. I have the Ilkovich equation here, okay, just as we saw it before. But look at that. My computer's on its own again. I will also put in a pilot ion, my ion that is of a known material, and I'm going to assume that the current that I get for that species per electron is going to be the same for my pilot ion as my unknown species. And so the system has, of course, 708 and 708 are the same. If they're both n is equal to 2, then I just cross them out. If n is equal to 1 here and n is equal to 2 here, well, that's no problem either. I'm using the same, I'm actually putting my pilot ion into my solution, into my unknown solution. So I have my unknown ion in there as well as my internal standard added right to the same solution. So I'm doing the electrochemistry and the mass flow rate and the time are the same because it's the same solution, same experiment. So I don't worry about those. You get into a little trouble right here with the diffusion coefficients. If I choose a species that has a similar diffusion coefficient as my ion of interest, my unknown ion, I might be okay. How do you do that? Well, you think about things that have similar ionic radii have similar diffusion coefficients. So if I have two monovalent ions that have similar hydrated radius, then they're going to have similar diffusion coefficients. But if I have a big an ion that has a large hydrated radius and another ion that has a very small hydrated radius, they're probably going to have different diffusion coefficients. So matching those diffusion coefficients is a little bit of a tricky thing. Obviously, stop doing that. Obviously, if I select them carefully, I can cross them out. If I don't select them carefully, I could actually put them in there. I could actually look them up and stick them in there. Okay, so then I just ratio my currents for the unknown system, material and the pilot or the internal standard. In my electrochemistry that we're talking about, polarography, I might do it like this. Okay, where I don't have it on there. Yep. I don't have a slide on that. But I could have the unknown ion and the pilot ion. And I measure the diffusion coefficient, or it's not the diffusion coefficient, the diffusion current for the pilot, and I measure the diffusion current for the unknown, and I take their ratio, and that tells me their concentration. Or if I know the concentration of the pilot, then I can calculate the concentration of the unknown. So this is a standard internal calibration method. So we've got absolute calibration, calibration curve, and internal standard. Okay, three methods. The last one is standard additions. This one is probably the most important one for electrochemistry. Standard additions is used more in electrochemistry than any other calibration method. Why? For some of the reasons that I mentioned already in the calibration curve method. Now, we use calibration curves in other areas of chemistry more often. But in electrochemistry, I got a little bit of difficulty, right? I got that electrochemical cell that every time I run a solution, I got to dump the thing out. I got to rinse everything off, rinse all my electrodes off, make sure there's no crossover contamination. I even have a problem if I have, now I use distilled water. If I put a sample in there, the distilled water that I use to rinse everything off will dilute the sample a little bit. Oh, I better get out a Kim wipe and dry off my electrodes and dry out the Kim wipe may have contaminated. Did you know that there is zinc in Kim wipes? Yeah, things that we do in our spare time in the laboratory, okay? There's zinc. Somehow it's used in the process of making those Kim wipes. I don't want to mess that. I don't want to be wiping my electrodes down with a zinc wipe. We used to call them zinc wipes. Because it would contaminate the sample with zinc. So calibration curves are a little bit difficult. Absolute calibration has its flaws. Internal standard methods can be a little bit difficult. Standard additions are the easy way to go. And we like easy, right? We like easy. All right? Here's how you do it. I take my unknown solution. I want to measure cadmium. I put the solution into the cell, set up my electrochemical system, make a measurement. I get a current for the unknown, amount of cadmium in my system. I then take a standard of cadmium. Maybe it's at a high concentration. Maybe I'm measuring part per billion concentrations, but my standard is at 1 ppm. I take a micropipette, and I take maybe 10 microliters of it, and I shoot it into my electrochemical cell. Purge with nitrogen, stir or whatever to mix it in there. stop everything, run the experiment again. Now I get the current due to the original unknown amount plus a little extra current due to the spike that I added. If I want to, I can add a couple of spikes and generate almost a calibration curve. I don't have to change the solution. I don't have to do anything fancy. I don't have to look up anything in the literature. I don't have to try and find the same conditions for my diffusion coefficients that I have in my system. All I'm doing is spiking in additional amounts of standard, generating a standard addition curve. Okay? So this is all described here for you. The equation looks a little hairy, but it's not. It's really quite simple. The concentration of the unknown, that's not copper, that's C sub U, okay, not Cu. Okay? Concentration of unknown is equal to this ratio where I measure the current of the original unknown solution, the volume of my spike that I spiked in, the concentration of the spike divided by current for the spike, current after I add the spike, volume of the spike, plus the two currents, subtract the original current from the spike current, times the original volume of the sample. And again, that's another one of those equations that's really easy to derive if you wanted to. Another way to look at it, let's see if I could plot current versus concentration. I first do my unknown, okay? Then I measure, I spike in some amount of standard, and all of a sudden I keep spiking it and I get a nice curve. I extrapolate that curve back, actually. I extrapolate that curve back. Now, it shouldn't. If it goes through zero, that means I have zero in my. Let me do this. Let me do this right. Current, concentration. I do my unknown. I don't know what it's. We'll call this zero. This is concentration added. All right. So no concentration added. I get some current value. This is the unknown amount of stuff. I then add some spikes. Okay? I get a curve, I get a line like this. The concentration, the x-intercept is my concentration of my unknown. It's a negative value because of the way I plotted it. But that's my concentration of my unknown. Okay? And that's all that this equation is doing for you. All right. So much for calibration methods and analytical chemistry. Our little interlude is done. We can apply this to electrochemistry, all forms of electrochemistry, but we got to move on. Okay? We got to talk about variations on polarography. And I'm probably up to electrochemical technique number 9 or 10. And the technique is going to be AC polarography. Now, I told you that DC polarography was good and okay, and wow, what a great find 100 years ago. But we need to distinguish between capacitive and Faradaic current. So, some smart person came along and said, what if we apply an alternating current wave on top of our potential time curve. Remember, E versus time, I've been drawing these curves over and over again, it's just a straight line. But instead of just making it a straight line, I'm going to apply a sine wave on top of that. So, I get this curve, sine wave. Okay? I apply that to my electrochemical cell. I then get really smart and say, I'm not just going to measure the current that's produced, because remember, we measure I versus E. I'm not going to just measure the current. I'm going to measure how the current fluctuates as a function of my applied sine wave, my applied AC wave. Okay? Here's what happens. The surface concentrations at the electrode surface change in response to the AC potential. This is a blown up view of one of these waves, right? So I blow it up and I say, okay, I'm going to measure reduction, E cathodic versus time. Look at that. If my E one half were here, okay, so I'm going to look at one of those sine waves in the vicinity of my E one half. I've scanned along and I've got to the point where I'm near the E one half. What happens is nothing if I'm down here. If I'm below the E one half, nothing's going to happen, right? Because I haven't reached a sufficient potential to cause the species to reduce. If I get above the E one half, I now cause the species to reduce, so I've crossed over the line, and now ox is going to red in this whole region right here. As long as I'm above the E one half, as long as I'm at potentials more negative than the E one half, I'm going to get reduction. In the course of my sine wave, I go back below the E one half. I go back into this region. I now am in a region where red is being converted back to ox. Because I'm not at a potential that's sufficient to reduce ox to red, but I'm at more oxidizing potentials. So this sine wave thing is changing. Okay, it's changing the system. I then go back, I continue along, and I go back over the E1 half line, and I get reduction again. So there's this reduction, oxidation going on because of this AC wave that I put onto my applied waveform. Wow, there's a lot of words on this slide. What we're going to do is we're going to measure the AC component of that current. We're not going to just measure the total current, but we're going to measure the AC component. We're going to look for a fluctuation. If I'm at potentials far away from the E1 half, let's say I haven't reached the E1 half yet, I'm cycling up and down, but I'm not getting anything because I'm not sufficiently negative to cause the reaction to occur. So nothing happens. I get no signal, zero signal. I get near the E1 half and I begin to see reduction, oxidation. That's good because there's a fluctuation of the current and I can measure that fluctuation. So I'm measuring how it changes from reduction, oxidation. I'm measuring that AC component of my current. I then go past the E1 half, way above the line, and it's reduction all the time. Is there an AC component? No more AC component. Because I just keep reducing, even though the signal is fluctuating up and down, I'm doing reduction all the time. So, current fluctuates because a positive reduction or reducing current is produced above the E1 half, and a negative oxidation current is produced below the E1 half. A peak is generated only in the vicinity of the E1 half, only near the E1 half, because that's the only region where the current is fluctuating. All the rest of the time, it's either constant oxidizing current or constant reducing current. Even though there's a fluctuation in the potential, that fluctuation is not sufficient to cause the back and forth, the oxidation and reduction. So early in the experiment, there's no current. Late in the experiment, the current is constant, and therefore there is no AC component measured. Let's see. Here it is, right here in the middle. I end up, what I had before in classic DC polarography, classic linear sweep voltammetry, with a linear waveform, I had this funny looking squiggly thing. I come down here, because I got this AC component that I'm measuring, I get a peak. I only get the peak in the vicinity of the E1 half, where that applied AC waveform is causing oxidation, reduction. So therefore, I'm measuring that component, that AC component, and I see it. Once I get above the E1 half and there's no more AC component to the current, I go back down and get a flat baseline again. So by going to AC polarography, I've improved the situation. Okay, this just tells you some of the parameters. 60 to 100 hertz is the frequency. Higher frequencies require faster electron transfer rates to keep up with it. Irreversible processes generate no AC wave. If the applied potential goes up and the system doesn't respond and then comes back down, I get nothing. Okay. Magnitude of the AC voltage is 10 millivolts peak to peak. And let's see. Okay, advantages. Detection limits are better than in DC polarography, but you're still limited by capacitive current. It does help with the capacitive current, but not completely. Capacitive current produces an AC component associated with charging and discharging. So there is some capacitive current associated with just that AC sine wave. Produces a peak and not a wave. Okay, waves we don't like. Peaks are easier to measure. Multiple components gives multiple peaks. So I got two things in there, I got two peaks. I got three things, I got three peaks. And we can use solid electrodes. We don't have to use a dropping mercury electrode. If it's AC polarography, it's a dropping mercury electrode. If it's not a dropping mercury electrode, it's a form of AC voltammetry. What else we got? All right. Since we have lots of time left, let me just mention phase selective AC polarography. In phase selective AC polarography, I'm doing the same experiment, but I'm relying on the fact that the capacitive current and the Faradaic current are out of phase with one another. So here's my applied waveform. It's a sine wave. It's a little ugly because I drew it myself. And the current goes up when my potential goes up, and it comes down when my potential comes down. So I get a sine wave, and that's what we were measuring in our AC component in the previous experiment. But now, okay, that's the Faradaic current. Now I'm going to superimpose on it capacitive current. Capacitive current lags the Faradaic current. Why does it lag? Because when I apply a voltage to the system, ions have to flow and line up at the electrode surface in order to create that capacitive effect. It takes time for that current to develop. That capacitive current is slow in developing. It lags the Faradaic current by 90 degrees. Not really drawn to scale in my diagram, but approximately 90 degree lag. So my Faradaic current goes up, my capacitive current comes up later. Well, if there's a phase, again, on a scale of time or degrees, radians, whatever you want to call it, if there's a lag time, then I could use that lag time to distinguish between the capacitive and Faradaic currents. Right? At some locations in this curve, here's a line. Here, the Faradaic current is high, the capacitive current is low. Over here, capacitive current is almost zero. Faradaic current is a negative value, but it's large. Over here, same thing. Capacitive current is low, Faradaic current is high. All right? So we can, by doing phase selective, in other words, I'm only looking at the current, the total current of the system. Remember, I can't actually tell the difference between Faradaic and capacitive. I'm just measuring the total current. I measure the total current, but I'm doing it at certain points during my AC curve. So I'm looking for that phase shift. I'm looking for the out-of-phase ability to distinguish. Or I'm using this out-of-phase shift of the capacitive and Faradaic current to distinguish between them. Hello? Oh, okay. I got little circles in there. I already drew them. Measure current when IC is minimum. All right. So I have circles where you measure it. It doesn't go to zero, but it's a minimum. All right. So instead of measuring total AC current, measure current only at times at selected points when in the cycle when the I capacitive is a minimum, I Faradaic is a maximum. selectively measure IF in the presence of IC. So what we're doing is we're getting selective measurement of Faradaic current in the presence of capacitive current. You get about a 10-fold improvement in rejection of capacitive current and better detection limits. Okay, phase selective AC polarography and phase selective AC voltammetry. The difference between polarography and voltammetry, dropping mercury electrode versus some other electrode. Same is true for digitized version of a sine wave or pulsed waveform. So, in other words, I was doing a sine wave like this. What if I do... Same thing. Same thing happens. It's just called... Instead of this being an AC wave, this is AC, this is pulsed. That's the terminology. But it's the same idea. It's just alternating it. Okay? So pulsed waveforms, there's pulsed polarography and pulsed voltammetry where I'm applying pulsed waveforms and I'm these are two different waveforms, right? Here I got a ramp and I'm just putting little pulses on the ramp. Here, I just have pulses with no ramp. And I just keep increasing. You can come up with your own waveform and name it after yourself. All right. During the pulse sequence, if I'm pulsing, I pulse the potential. The Faradaic current goes up and drops off according to the Cottrell equation. The capacitive current goes up and drops off exponentially. What do we got here? Cottrell, exponential decay. All right. Look at that. This is exciting. Okay, so what do I want to do? I want to measure the current in these little windows. You see these little windows here? Why do I want to measure there? Because those are the locations at the end of the pulse. I did a pulse, but I wait till the end, and I find out that, yes, my Faradaic current has dropped off, but my capacitive current has also dropped off. And I can measure some Faradaic current with minimum amount of capacitive current. Now, this is a little bit fiction because you don't get zero capacitive current. You get lower capacitive current. But this is how pulsed waveforms, same thing as AC, how pulsed waveforms allow you to distinguish between capacitive and Faradaic current. Only measure current during the latter part of the pulse. Take advantage of the fact that the capacitive current decays more rapidly than the Faradaic current, improves the detection limits to about 10 to the minus 7th molar. We're now in the nanomolar region. We're below the micromolar region. We're in the nanomolar region, and we can do this easily with modern instrumentation. Okay, here's some, I showed you those already, and we're gonna quit because I can tell by the look on your face that the weekend has already started.